This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Bush administration describes the men it holds at Guantanamo Bay as the worst of the worst, dangerous men with information vital to the war on terrorism. Several new reports paint a very different picture of those enemy combatants. Many may, in fact, be neither enemies nor combatants and could be guilty of no more than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And whether they're just unlucky or diehard terrorists, all of them are stuck in legal limbo. Set up soon after 9/11 to house prisoners from the war in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay has grown from the temporary Camp X-Ray into the multi-million-dollar Camp Delta. About 500 men remain. There are no female prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Their legal standing can be described as surreal. They are not, the administration insists, prisoners of war. Only a very few have been charged with any crimes. They may or may not be within the jurisdiction of U.S. federal courts. None knows when or even if he will ever be released. The Bush administration says that all are treated humanely and that none is tortured. Many international organizations, most recently the UN Human Rights Commission, disagree. They demand that prisoners be either tried or released and that Guantanamo Bay be closed. Later in the program, sleep is on the Talk of the Nation opinion page this week. An historian argues that Thomas Edison has a lot to answer for. But first, a fresh look at Guantanamo Bay. If you have questions about conditions at the prison, who's there, who isn't, or what laws apply, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our first guest returned from Guantanamo Bay over this past weekend. Con Coughlin is defense and security editor for Britain's Daily Telegraph, also the author of American Ally, Tony Blair and the War on Terror. He joins us from his home in London. Nice to have you back on the program, Con.
Great to be with you, Neil.
Most of us think of Guantanamo Bay, and the image we get, I guess, is the old Camp X-Ray, the idea of these outdoor cages.
Yes, well, those cages are now completely overgrown with ivy and the only things you find in the cages are the things called banana rats, which are one of the local delicacies in Guantanamo. Hmm. But on a serious level, the American military has turned Guantanamo into a modern prison camp. I mean, that's what it is. There are five separate camps now, and each camp holds a different category of prisoner from those that are fully compliant with the prison camp regime to those sort of hardline, hardcore Al-Qaeda people who just won't have anything to do with it and are basically indulging in a dirty protest and just refuse to have anything to do with it. But I think the thing that really struck me when I went to Guantanamo last week is the size of it. I mean, this is like a small American town. The guards live in suburban streets and things like that, in very nice houses. The conditions in which the prisoners are held have vastly improved from those first harrowing images we saw of the people in their orange jumpsuits being led around chained to guards. So it has evolved, and I think the impression I took away from Guantanamo is that it is going to stay a detention facility for a very long time to come.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of the prisoners there?
No, I wasn't allowed to. I could see them, but we weren't allowed to talk to them by the camp authorities.
As it was described to you then, I understand that their conditions vary quite a bit depending on how much they're willing to cooperate with their jailers.
Yes, I mean, the military officials I spoke to, who previously had no experience of detaining prisoners, said that basically it is modelled on what goes on inside a federal state, a federal penitentiary in the United States. And so a prisoner that doesn't behave, who doesn't abide by the rules, is treated very harshly indeed. They are held basically in solitary confinement with very, very few personal effects. They're allowed 3 30-minute exercise periods a week. And that's it, really. I mean, but a lot of these people, as I say, are die-hard Al-Qaeda fighters. I mean, they make no bones about it in their interrogations. They say they are committed to Al-Qaeda. If released, they would continue their attacks against the Americans. and in several cases they've tried to attack and seriously injure the guards that are holding them.
Mm-hmm. Which has prompted several of the incidents of which we've read.
Well, that's right. I mean, the guards are only human, and, you know, I think when you hear, I mean, some of the things I heard that went on, so far as the prisoners were concerned, so the way they tried to assault the guards and the manner by which they do so, which I won't repeat over a civilized radio program, but you can see why the guards, who are only human, have overreacted in the way they have. But I did speak to the camp commander, who said that he'd been there 2 years. He had investigated 15 allegations made against the guards, and of those, only five, in his view, stood up, and disciplinary action had been taken against the guards. So given that they're holding 500 people 24 hours a day for over a four-year period, you know, five upheld complaints is not excessive.
What about the hunger strikers of whom we've read, who are, we've also read, force-fed?
Well, force-feeding, as you probably know, Neil, has been deemed by the United Nations to be torture. Basically, the United Nations argue that the detainees had the right to take their own lives. Now, the camp officials say that it is their duty to protect life, to preserve life. And so some of the detainees are being force-fed. Now, I asked a lot of questions about this, as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
At the height of the force-feeding, at the height of the hunger strikes, there were 100 detainees refusing food. When I left at the end of last week, there were five detainees still being force-fed. Of those, only one of the detainees had been on hunger strike since it first started last August.
Now, 4 years on, just about 5 years on for some of these guys, do these prisoners still have useful information?
Well, that's what the authorities say at Guantanamo. I mean, basically, there are two big arguments made by American officials for continuing to detain these people who were picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan in the fall, early winter of 2001. The first is that if released, they would launch further terror attacks against the United States and coalition allies. The second is that they continue to provide valuable information to help in the fight against global terrorism. And certainly, you know, from my own domestic perspective, they gave me information that related to the London bombings that took place in July last year. And the American officials I spoke to insist that these detainees are still capable of providing current relevant intelligence that can help fight in the global war against terrorism.
And we've also read of a dozen or so, at least according to the Department of Defense, who have, after being released from Guantanamo Bay, returned to the battlefield and have been subsequently picked up in other operations. But again, not a lot of documentary evidence of that.
No, I think the most bizarre case I heard was of a former Afghan fighter who received battlefield injuries and was treated by the medical staff at Guantanamo. They have a very state-of-the-art medical facility there, and he was fitted with a prosthetic leg. He was then released because he was deemed not to be a security threat. I think 250 out of the original 750 detainees have now been released. But this individual, with his brand-new prosthetic leg, was found attacking Americans in Afghanistan a few months after his release.
You've your most recent book is about the alliance between the United States and Britain. Tony Blair, very loyal to George W. Bush, nonetheless feels that Guantanamo Bay is a liability.
Yes, well, I think this is again shows the difference in approach between Europe and the United States. Of course, you know, the United States has suffered a far more serious attack than Britain or its allies in Europe. But yes, you're quite right. Tony Blair, who has been very steadfast in his support for President Bush since 9/11, does beg to differ with him on the issue of Guantanamo. And of course, remember, Tony Blair was previously a lawyer before he became Prime Minister. And his view is that it is legally untenable. You either try these people, you change the law so you can try them, or you release them. And or you find another way to deal with it, like send them back to their home country.
Con Coughlin, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Neil.
Con Coughlin, defense and security editor of the Daily Telegraph, published, of course, in Britain. He is also the author, most recently, of American Ally Tony Blair and the War on Terror, and he joined us by phone from his home in London. With us here in Studio 3A is Corinne Hegland, a reporter for the National Journal, who's written another account of what's been going on at Guantanamo Bay. And one of the things that you've discovered in your account in the National Journal, Corinne, is enemy combatants. In fact, you say there's some evidence to believe that a lot of the men being held at Guantanamo Bay were neither enemy nor combatants.
Yes, that's accurate. The majority of the men in Guantanamo Bay are actually not accused of having taken part in hostilities against the United States.
So not picked up on the battlefield?
Not picked up on the battlefield. The majority were picked up by third parties, and the largest single group was actually picked up in Pakistan by Pakistani third parties, who then turned them over to Pakistani authorities, who held them in prison and then gave them to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And others were, in fact, turned over by the Northern Alliance, a group that was battling the Taliban before the United States got into the war.
Yes, our local allies within Afghanistan also captured some men and turned them over to the United States as well. Some of those people the Northern Alliance captured had surrendered on the battlefield to the Northern Alliance. Others came in drips and drabs from all other areas.
Mm-hmm. So it's possible that your story is arguing that some of these men may in fact be telling very elaborate and well-told lies about what they were doing there and in Afghanistan in the first place or in Pakistan. But that in fact, if you go in and check their stories, at least according to what their families say, there's reason to believe that some of them may be right.
That's accurate. The lawyers... Most of the men in Guantanamo Bay now have a petition pending in federal court in which they have asked for a federal judge to review their case. Those petitions have been brought by about 500 volunteer American lawyers, and many of those lawyers have gone overseas to meet with the men's families before meeting with the men. The stories that the families told those lawyers matched what the detainees are telling U.S. authorities now.
We'll be back with more about this report in the National Journal. We'll also be talking with Robert Chesney, a law professor at Wake Forest Law School, who teaches about national security law, and take your calls about Guantanamo Bay. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Guantanamo Bay. A recent UN Human Rights Commission report calls for all terror suspects held at that prison to be tried with a crime or released and the prison to be closed. Our guest is Corinne Hegland, who's a reporter for the National Journal. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Evie. Evie calling us from Boise in Idaho.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air, please.
Well, first I want to say I'm appalled at what my government has done. And I'm just horrified that we haven't charged or released. I agree with the UN. And I want to know, have the names of the detainees, the prisoners down there, ever been released?
Corinne?
Not formally, no. Many of the names have come out through court proceedings, either brought by the men or by their families. But the U.S. government so far has declined to release those names.
There also have been well over 100 men who've been released from Guantanamo Bay. Have they also explained who some of the other people being held were?
No. When men are released, they're released in anonymous statements saying so-and-so was transferred to, say, the Yemeni government today.
Mm-hmm.
None of the names have ever been formally released.
Mm-hmm.
May I ask another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Where are they released?
Where are they released?
Yes.
Where are they released?
Largely to their home countries. Early on, there were one or two large batches of men who were sent home to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Since then, men have been released to the UK, Australia, Denmark, and then a number of Middle Eastern countries. Some have been transferred for continued detention in their home countries, and others have been outright released.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the phone call. In terms of the stories that these men tell about where they were, what they were doing when they were picked up by various people and eventually found their way to Guantanamo, what sources are you using? Were you left believing them?
What I did is I looked at the federal court files. The Defense Department has declined to release names or information about these men, but by virtue of the cases that their lawyers have filed in court, the Defense Department has had to file evidence records of about 20 to 60 pages long on each individual man. And this consists of what the man told his government tribunal that decided he was an enemy combatant and the government's evidence against him. And for the most part, the stories match up. What the men tell their tribunal matches the charges against them.
Mm-hmm.
When those diverge, then it's often another detainee has fingered the man or he may be lying. It's not clear. But they actually don't diverge very often.
Some of the accounts that you have in your story, Surreal doesn't seem to contain it. There's a man who says, finally, after hours and hours and hours of questioning, yes, I saw Osama bin Laden five times, including twice on television.
That's accurate. Somebody had fingered him as a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden. He says he was not a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden, and the interrogators pushed him and pushed him and pushed him and pushed him and finally said, fine, I saw bin Laden five times, three times in Al Jazeera and twice on Yemeni News. And after that, the interrogators dug in some more and some more and some more, and eventually they got this detainee admitted to knowing bin Laden. But he didn't. He just saw him on television.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that just strains belief that anybody would. It's not useful to put information that dumb in somebody's interrogation file.
There's somebody else who slammed his hands on the table after a very long interrogation and said, fine, you got me. I'm a terrorist. This man is an alcoholic Saudi. His interrogators knew it was a sarcastic admission, but the government tried to use it against him later. Detainee admitted he is a terrorist. He told his interrogators, and his interrogator sought out a U.S. military officer to say, hey, this was sarcasm. It's not a confession.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Tim. Tim calling us from Miami.
Hello. Greetings to you, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two related questions. First is how the U.S. finds itself running a detention center in, of all countries, Cuba, and next, what moral or ethical grounds do we have to hold anyone that's not a prisoner of war without charge?
First question, Cuba, there's a lease on Guantanamo Bay.
We have a long-standing lease with Cuba for which we pay a certain amount of money each year, and that lease can only be broken with the cooperation of both parties, the United States and Cuba.
Cuba, it should be pointed out, does not cash the check.
Yes.
And the other question?
I'm sorry. The other one is, did you guys get it?
That was about where do we, excuse me, Tim, I don't mean to paraphrase, but where do we get the ethical and moral grounds to hold prisoners without charge? Is that it?
That's right.
Okay.
I can't answer that question per se. I can say legally the administration says that these are enemy combatants, and the executive, the commander-in-chief, has long had the authority to hold enemy combatants, people who fought against us in detention until the end of hostilities.
And I should point out in Corrine Hegland's story ends with a set of rhetorical questions. Who would do differently? Who would raise their hand to release the man who might fly into the next skyscraper? These are not easy decisions.
No.
Yeah. Tim, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, thank you.
For more on the legal questions about Guantanamo Bay, we turn now to Bobby Chesney, a law professor at Wake Forest University's School of Law. He specializes in national security law, and he's with us from the studios of member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Neil. It's great to be here.
And maybe you can expound a little bit on the legal grounds the Bush administration argues for its right to detain these men.
Sure. Maybe I'll do this by mentioning the UN report that you brought up earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
This UN report that came out last week is a very interesting document. It's most notable because it denies that the U.S. has the legal authority to detain anyone at Guantanamo. And that's a position I disagree with, and perhaps I can answer your original question by explaining why that is. First of all, it helps to back up and think of what happened after 9/11. Not only did the president and the executive branch determine that we're in a state of armed conflict with al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but also let's not forget that Congress took the same position when it authorized the use of military force on September 18th, 2001,
mm-hmm.
against the entities that perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, which of course turns out to be al-Qaeda, and also entities that harbor al-Qaeda, which turns out to be the Taliban. NATO took the view that the 9/11 attacks had been an armed attack on the United States. The UN Security Council on the 12th enacted a resolution that referred to the U.S. right of self-defense against armed attacks. So there's clearly a ground for concluding that we have a state of armed conflict between the United States and al-Qaeda. And that's the important factor to keep in mind when you're figuring out why do we have the legal right to operate Guantanamo. And it has to do with the laws of war that come into play when you have a state of armed conflict. Now, the laws of war have long established that in addition to having the right to shoot at the opponent. You have the right to capture that person, and in lieu of killing that person, you can detain them. You can detain them for the duration of hostilities. It's a fundamental concept that comes along with the laws of war. And at bottom, the Guantanamo facility is a facility to carry out that detention. Now, there's a difference between saying that we have that lawful right and that it's good policy to execute that right in the way that we have. And so let me get that distinction out there right now.
Yeah, I was going to say the laws of war are seemingly encapsulated in the Geneva Conventions, which the administration says do not apply in this case.
Well, it's interesting, and I don't want to get into too many of the details because it may drive away the listenership, but the position is that the Geneva Conventions applied as to the conflict with the Taliban in Afghanistan, but not with what I guess you could characterize as the closely intertwined conflict with al-Qaeda, which is both in Afghanistan and elsewhere. As to the Taliban, the administration concluded that although the conventions did apply, the Taliban forces did not qualify for prisoner of war status under the conventions, whereas with al-Qaeda, since the administration took the position that the conventions did not apply at all, you never reached that status question.
Mm-hmm. But without that status, then there is this new status, enemy combatant.
Well, you know, lurking in the background of all this is the question of, well, how about how we treat these people once they're detained? And so maybe it's worth pausing to draw a few distinctions here that I always want to emphasize with my students when we talk about this. There's really at least three separate legal questions, and each one of them can also be a policy question, of course.
Mm-hmm.
First, do we have the right legally to use military detention at all? Second, even if we do have that right, are we using the right or legally sufficient procedures to figure out that a given detainee is within the scope of that power to detain?
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, even if you've correctly categorized someone as, for example, an al-Qaeda member, what are the legal rules for how you treat them? And I think it's important to bear in mind that the U.S. could have very strong grounds on one of those prongs of the argument, but perhaps less strong grounds on the other. I think we're certainly strongest on this baseline question of, do we have the right to use military detention? The UN report takes the position that we don't have that right. I'm going to quote from the report here. It says that terrorism suspects should be detained in accordance with criminal procedure. And skipping ahead, we should expeditiously bring all Guantanamo detainees to trial, meaning criminal trial,
mm-hmm.
or release them. Now, the significance of this, of course, is that it reflects sort of the traditional perspective that terrorism is simply a criminal law problem to which you can apply traditional criminal justice procedures.
There's also, and we're going to get more listeners involved and hear some more about this, but there's the choice of Guantanamo Bay, kind of a non-place the Bush administration hoped that would be outside, the courts would agree, would be outside the jurisdiction of U.S. federal courts. Doesn't that weaken the case that if they're being held with perfect right, put them in Leavenworth?
Well, bear in mind that we're not talking about citizens detained there, nor are we talking about people who were captured in the U.S. who were then brought there. You're talking in each instance about a non-citizen captured, whether by us or by someone else, captured overseas, and all initially, before coming to Guantanamo, all held in locations or in situations where it is relatively clear that the U.S. courts would not have jurisdiction. Now, at this moment, there are any number of military detainees, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and no one would contend that, at least in the case of non-citizens, there's no serious contention that the U.S. courts could exercise jurisdiction over those detentions. So the baseline from which people came into Guantanamo wasn't a baseline of federal court supervision, but a baseline of no federal court supervision.
Mm.
Now, that said, you're right. This was chosen because there was a belief that that condition would continue to obtain if we used Guantanamo. There was a memorandum from the Office of Legal Counsel that considered that question, said that it's a debatable issue, but probably the courts would not assert jurisdiction. That turned out to be wrong in 2004, and Congress recently enacted legislation to try to restore that expected status quo.
And suspending habeas corpus for these men. Let's get some more listeners involved in this conversation and turn to Bob. Bob's with us from Westwood, Massachusetts.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a twofold question. First, if you recall John Walker, the American Taliban, my mm-hmm. question for your guest is, what distinction legally does it make where the birthplace is or citizenship of the government combatant is? And what gives us a right to force feed a human being in our custody? The second part of the question is, when do we know this al-Qaeda or the war on terrorism is over and we can resume constitution and get rid of this temporary suspension.
Mm-hmm.
I will listen from the radio. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Those are great questions, each of them. Let me start with John Walker Lind. A lot of people like to compare the John Walker Lind case with the case of Yasser Hamdi, who was much in the news a couple of years ago, and who was one of the enemy combatants held in the U.S. You have one who's put through the military detention process, Hamdi, and then Lind, who was brought back to the U.S. and very famously prosecuted in the regular criminal justice system. My students often ask, you know, what explains that disparate treatment? In both cases, you had U.S. citizens, one getting the military treatment, one getting the criminal justice treatment. And I think a big part of the answer lies in the newness of this situation and the lack of very clear existing procedures, especially in late 2001, early 2002, as to how to handle various persons, and perhaps also differences in what the available evidence was in each case. But Bob's question really raises sort of a distinct question. Lind, he's a citizen. He ends up in the usual criminal justice system. Everyone else is a non-citizen. They seem to all end up at Guantanamo. Why the difference based on citizenship? And again, I want to distinguish between what's lawful and what's good policy. There may be policy reasons to criticize what the system provides for, but from a legal perspective, it's certainly the case that a citizen has the right to invoke constitutional rights that are very important civil liberties protections in this context, and a non-citizen, at least when held outside the United States, is going to have, at the very least, a very difficult time establishing the ability to invoke those rights. Now, that's actually an interesting question at Guantanamo, where the extent of U.S. control, which you were describing earlier, Neil, the extent of U.S. control raises the question whether perhaps we have so much control there that even non-citizens pick up civil liberties protections under our Constitution. That's in litigation right now.
We're talking about Guantanamo Bay today. Our guests are Bobby Chesney, a law professor at Wake Forest School of Law, and Corrine Hegland, a reporter for the National Journal. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, Corrine, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation here. These men's lawyers, when they talk to them, the UN Commission on Human Rights is not alone in saying simply the extent of this incarceration with no time frame, no known time when they will be released, that in itself is a form of abuse.
One of the lawyers has a man who is on hunger strike, who is not accused of having taken part in hostilities against the United States. He is not accused of having fought the United States, and he was determined to kill himself if at all possible. And his lawyer explained it to me. Look, he's determined to be released one way or the other. I mean, to be held for 4 years with no charges, not knowing what the end is, somebody saying you'll be released tomorrow, next week, somebody else saying no, you won't be. It's very difficult for a mind to go through.
Mm-hmm. And the fact is, isn't it right, Bobby Chesney, that even in some cases, if these men are found innocent by their tribunals, if those go ahead, they could end up still being held indefinitely.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the case of the Uyghur detainees, perhaps, who are still held in Guantanamo after a combatant status review tribunal, which has the job of figuring out whether you're someone who's within the scope of military detention, determined that they were no longer enemy combatants. I think it's worth emphasizing that the reason we're still holding those individuals is that they're, as I understand it, they're Chinese nationals, and the United States government is concerned that if they are returned to the Chinese government, they may face a substantial risk of cruel or torture or other abusive treatment.
A condition in which, you must admit, it makes your head spin.
Well, I'm not sure I follow you there, Neil.
They're being held at Guantanamo Bay for fear that they might be released to China and be tortured. Some would be saying, pick your torturer.
Well, what the State Department's been doing is contacting third nations in an effort to try to find a location to accept them. And we haven't released them in the time being. Let me contrast this with the position taken by about, I think, 36 different habeas petitioners at Guantanamo Bay have each filed actions trying to get a court in D.C. to order the government not to release them from Guantanamo to their home countries, their states of citizenship, precisely on the grounds that we're declining to entirely release the Uyghur detainees. Mm-hmm. I also understand that the Uyghur detainees are not actually being held in the same conditions of confinement as the rest of the detainees, as Khan described it earlier.
Yes.
They are, however, still being detained, and the Uyghurs actually are not the only non-enemy combatants or no longer enemy combatants who are in detention. There are at least two individuals of other nationalities who are also in that position of being no longer enemy combatants, but they are still being held in Guantanamo Bay, and they do not have full liberties.
Hmm. All right, we got
right,
to put,
that's,
all right, I'm sorry, we have to put this on hold just because we got to take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more and take a couple more calls after the break. We're also going to go to the Talk of the Nation opinion page, where we'll examine the notion of a good night's sleep. Turns out that's a modern invention. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Send us email, talk@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In just a couple of minutes, we'll go to the Talk of the Nation opinion page. We'll be talking about a history of sleep, but right now we're wrapping up our conversation on Guantanamo Bay. Our guests are Corrine Hegland, a reporter for the National Journal, and Bobby Chesney, a law professor at Wake Forest School of Law. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Angela. Angela calling us from, was that Marbreth?
Narberth,
Pennsylvania. Okay, go ahead.
I was wondering, considering the fact that the relatives of any criminal that you could think of, let alone the terrorist, are always astonished that these people are involved in everything, and even the father of, like, Atta,
mm-hmm.
even when there was visible proof, always disclaimed the son's involvement. Is there some entity or some procedure whereby the stories that are being gleaned by the lawyers of these people can be checked with people maybe in the home country
mm-hmm.
Or some kind of cross-reference to back up any of these stories?
Of course, the possibility, Corrine Hegland, of lying does come up in your story.
It does, but fundamentally, what happens is the detainees have told the Defense Department stories that very closely match the stories that their families have given the lawyers individually. Now, they could be cover stories, or they could be the truth. We really don't have a mechanism in place for separating them out. There were a lot of reasons men went to Afghanistan before 9/11. Some went to fight with the Taliban. Some went for Al-Qaeda. Some went for charity. Some went to teach the Quran. Some went for cultural tourism, just to see what this government looked like before they returned to their lives elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we have men from all of those groups sitting in Guantanamo Bay today. When I say most of the men did not fight on the battlefield, that's not me talking. That's actually based on the government's own accusations against the men in the cases that I read. And then that finding, that most of the men did not fight the United States, was actually subsequently confirmed by a study from Seton Hall Law School that said the majority of the men in Guantanamo Bay are not accused of participating in hostilities.
Against the United States?
Against the United States.
Okay. Angela, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Andy. Andy's calling us from, I'm having a hard time reading the screen today. Emmaus, Pennsylvania, is that right?
Emmaus, PA.
Emmaus, all right. At least I didn't spell it wrong. I just thought there were too many vowels in there.
Yeah, it's a little baffling that way. In any case, I think one of the things that frustrates people so much in these conversations is that there are several that aren't happening. One is a legalese inch-by-inch parsing of they're not prisoners of war, they're enemy combatants, and the fact that apparently presidents always have this power and exercise it doesn't make people like me feel better about what we're doing now, the fact that it might always be going on. You know, well, that's just, you know, fuel to the fire. And it seems to me that it's a little bit, you know, the idea of asking what's the status of Guantanamo Bay and these people is a lot easier to understand if you switch the question around and say, to what question is Guantanamo Bay the answer? We're at war with a noun, I think is the only thing we ever declared war on, was terrorism. And unless you're a citizen of terrorism, which no one is, then you can't be a prisoner of war. You can't have a clear-cut situation. And where did we put them? We put them in one of the only places on Earth where there's no sovereignty. No one has a right in Guantanamo, not even the United States government. You know, we're in this limbo land, and it seems almost like this childish ollie ollie oxen free. Let's put them in a place where when the big problems come up, we'll be protected.
Andy, the Congress declared war against no one. It authorized the president to use force against those responsible for carrying out the attacks of 9/11 or those who harbored them.
Right, which is saying they authorized the use of force, which means that they're enemy combatants because we're in some kind of undefined conflict with various people, Taliban, Afghanistan, Iraq, whatever. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card for any kind of reasoning that you want to build up later. And it was the case is made to the American people. We're declaring war. In the 50s, it was communism, and now it's terrorism. Mm-hmm. But we're declaring war on a noun and then just doing kind of whatever you want to do, more or less, basing it on hiding behind that huge moniker. And well, so the idea of putting them down there is, well, you know.
I hear your frustration, Andy. I'll try to shape that into a form of a question, if I can, to Bobby Chesney. And that is not just the UN Commission on Human Rights, an organization that is not exactly, whose reputation is not exactly unblemished itself, but many others around the world, including the United States allies in Europe, including Britain, all say this is a liability at this point. Beyond the legalisms, do you think, Bobby Chesney, it is time to say that maybe Guantanamo Bay is costing the United States more than it gains?
Well, I'm glad to draw that distinction. It's not really a legal question, right? It's a policy question. And you have to ask yourself, if we were to close it down, then what? What do we do the next day if we capture, let's just assume for the sake of argument, Osama bin Laden? Mm-hmm. Now,
Is another super secret category of prisoners that we're not even talking about. Who knows where they're being held?
Exactly, yeah. Maybe I should give an example that doesn't go to the high
so
level.
Another of Osama's apparently innumerable number threes, okay?
Well, let's use a real example. We've got the so-called 20th hijacker down there, and I think it's generally understood that this is a person who would have been involved in the 9/11 attacks if he hadn't been turned away at the airport in Orlando. So if we were to shut down Guantanamo, what then? The option, according to the Commission on Human Rights authors, is to criminally charge that person or turn him loose. The problem with it may be, and I'm not sure whether his case is a great example of this or not, but the problem is, what if you don't have the type of evidence that's required to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt in a federal court process using the usual protections of criminal procedure? If you don't have that, do we really let them go? And do we take that approach, notwithstanding the fact that, according to the Congress, according to NATO, according to most observers, it is, in fact, an armed conflict, at least as to al-Qaeda? I agree that there's a lot of rhetorical
excess. Wait, but you're
throwing
NATO in there. I'll throw the EU in there. They say, close Guantanamo down.
Okay. But
and that includes everybody but Canada. And, I think Canada's on my side here.
You have a lot of international opinion that finds it very easy to say close down Guantanamo. And it may be that as a policy matter, it might even be a wise policy to get rid of Guantanamo in favor of some other military detention facility that doesn't have all the baggage that Guantanamo's picked up. But again, the question that interests me is whether or not if you're going to shut down Guantanamo, are you really going to rely on the traditional criminal justice process a la the 1990s or before, or are you going to simply shift them into some other location? I think I know a number of folks who are significant critics of Guantanamo, and in some ways I am one of these, think that in some respects, at least insofar as the federal courts are exercising oversight there, which is a issue that's much in play now thanks to Congress trying to remove some of that oversight. But as long as you have some federal court involvement, that's much more oversight than you're going to have in the detention facilities in Afghanistan and Iraq currently.
But there's another.
Let alone the CIA facilities.
There's another option, though. It's not just a matter of let them go or charge them in a federal criminal court. You can also charge them by court-martial, or they've set up these military commissions, which are entirely separate issue we won't go into. But you do have a military justice system in which charges could be brought as well.
All right.
Let me just throw this out there real quick. It's important to recognize that under the law of war, yes, you can prosecute someone for a war crime, but you're allowed to detain the enemy's fighters during the duration of the conflict without having to go through the trouble of prosecuting them and convicting them of a crime.
Look, we can argue this, and no doubt we will again. Bobby Chesney, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. Appreciate it.
Bobby Chesney, a professor at Wake Forest School of Law, and he teaches national security law there. Our thanks as well to Corinne Hegland, a reporter for the National Journal, who joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.